Firstly, thank you very much, and I have to give a yasher koach, special acknowledgement for the people who organize these kind of events. They don't happen on their own. They're the unsung heroes, really. So really, I think all of us should appreciate when efforts are made in these directions. So thank you, all of you who put this together. This kind of an event is really exactly what Yeshiva University is all about, and particularly the opportunity to address interesting topics, complex topics, with a group of our alumni is something which I think the Yeshiva in particular considers to be a very special opportunity. The topic of the day is a very vast and intricate one. We only have about half an hour, according to all calculations, or 40 minutes at the most. So we'll have to consider today's presentation more in the form of a talk to raise some issues and questions, things to think about and an approach, and maybe some other opportunity to go into more detail. The every society, every culture, has to develop a relationship to the concept of law. It's self-evident that every society needs to be governed by some sort of legal system. Minimally, to ensure that there's harmony in society, and to preclude anarchy, just in other words, to ensure coexistence, the parameters of interaction between different constituent members of any given society, it's necessary to have rules, rules which protect and establish boundaries, appropriate boundaries, between various groups and individual citizens. So that every society needs to cultivate an approach to law, and likely one which reflects its own values as well as the realities which it faces. In secular thinking, we encounter a wide range of perspectives about the nature and character of law. Again, we don't have time to elaborate very much, but very quickly, there are those who consider law to be basically a necessary evil. On the political realm, you could almost compare it, to the Democrats and the Republicans, in contemporary terms. The Republicans, as we know, are very wary of what they call big government. To them, law is necessary, but minimal interference in the lives of private citizens is more ideal. The Democratic Party, by and large, believes more in intervention. Again, this is not a political theory discussion, but we find a parallel in the world of law. There are those who felt that law is fundamentally intrusive, that the ideal would be to leave people as much as possible to their own devices and their own interests, of course, recognizing that we need to preclude anarchy. And what the Chazal call ishes chavero chayim bela'o, that one man will swallow up the other party if there aren't some sort of regulations, is a reality. But it's an unhappy reality, and therefore there were always those who, while they acknowledged the need for a legal system, tried to limit as much as possible the interference and the scope of that system. The positivists took this perspective. The famous view of Thomas Hobbes, who was governed by the notion of enlightened self-interest, and others who projected this idea of a limited concept of law. Even among those who had a wider, let's say, regard for the law, people like Plato and Aristotle, people who believed in some sort of divine or natural law, they believed that law reflected the aspirations of the people, that it was a mechanism which could be very productive. But even among that more ambitious, more positive group, one would say, the sense that law is human, created, and therefore very flexible to the needs of a given society, is, of course, the prevailing view. There might be natural or rational or even divine law, but even that is very flexible, reflecting dearly held values, but certainly amenable to change as efficiency and pragmatism would dictate. There's a famous quote, which I have here in the sheets, for those of you who have it, from Oliver Wendell Holmes in the beginning of his classic work on the common law, which reads as follows, just very quickly. The life of the law has not been logic. It has been experience, the felt necessities of time, the prevalent moral and political theories, intuitions of public policy avowed or unconscious, even the prejudices which judges share with their fellow men, have had great deal more to do than the syllogism in determining the rules by which men should be governed. The law embodies the story of a nation's development through many centuries. It cannot be dealt with as if it contained only the axioms and corollaries of a book of mathematics. In order to know what it is, we must know what it has been and what it tends to become. We must alternately consult history and existing theories of legislation. But the most difficult labor will be to understand the combination of the two into new products at every stage. The substance of the law at any given time pretty nearly corresponds, as far as it goes, with what is then understood to be convenient. But its form and machinery and the degree to which it is able to work out the desired results depend very much on its past. This is a statement which is not accepted by all, but it's a classical work. In a nutshell, it captures the view that many have with respect to political and secular law. Judaism's view of law, the halakha's view of law, is decidedly different even from this quotation. While on the one hand, it insists on retaining some of the flexibility, right, the idea that law needs to be able to respond, it has to be amenable to responding to and confronting contemporary challenges. That part of Holmes' definition is something that the halakha certainly embraces, the nimbleness of the law, the relevance of the law, the mechanisms within the law to respond to real problems in an effective way. That's a topic in its own right. But in terms of the idea that law is almost exclusively something that reflects contemporary mores, and that is subject to the principles of convenience and pragmatism, that is something which Jewish law, the halakha, fundamentally disputes. And let me highlight this in the following way. Number one, the halakha is divine law. That doesn't mean that there isn't a human or rabbinic component, certainly in the application of the law. Human beings are entrusted for its wise execution. But the source of the law and the principles of the law, according to Jewish tradition, come from Sinai in an act of revelation, divine revelation, come from the Almighty himself. This is, of course, a fundamental difference with secular law, but only the beginning of other more significant, more important differences. The Jewish view towards law is that it is beyond historical. It is ahistorical. Again, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist in time and it doesn't confront circumstances in each and every society. It does. Its capacity to do so is one of its primary features. However, it's more than the confrontation of the reality of any given society. It's not based on convenience and pragmatism primarily, but on idealism and embedded values. Chazal, the rabbinic tradition, tell us that the Torah, the halakha, was created before the world was created. And this is expressed both in mystical sources and in traditional rabbinic sources. The famous words of the Zohar, Istako b'oraisa u'bara alma, that the Torah, the laws of the Torah, were a blueprint for fairness, for justice, and for the construction of the world. Similarly, everybody is familiar with the first Rashi in Bereshis, Bereshis bara Elokim, Esa Shamayim ve'Esa Aretz. What is the word Bereshis in the beginning? So the first Rashi quotes the words of the Midrash, which say, Bishvil HaTorah Shanikra Reshis. The Torah was created so that there would be a means, there would be a place, a venue, to implement Jewish law. In other words, rather than law being exclusively an instrument for living in the world was constructed in such a fashion, according to rabbinic thinking, that the ideals of Jewish law, the high-minded, noble values that are reflected in Jewish law, would have a place in which to be implemented, in which to be executed. Not only prior to the world and the purpose of the world, you say Yom HaShishi, again, right in the beginning of Bereshis, we speak about the sixth day. And the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, again, Rashi quotes it because it's a very accepted midrash, that Yom HaShishi, Hei HaYadida, the sixth day, is actually an oblique reference, it's an allusion to the sixth day of Sivan, the day of the giving of the Torah, because the purpose of the world in rabbinic thinking is to have law which reflects values and which allows man, right, to be elevated and to develop as a kind of personality who lives a life which the Rabbonu Shalom, which the divine himself considered to be significant and important. This is true not only about prehistory and the purpose of history, it's true about post-history as well. We always hear a lot of talk about the Messianic era and much speculation of what will happen there, but the rabbinic view is codified in Maimonides' famous work in Hilchos Tshuva and Hilchos Malachim, based on the saying of Shmuel, who argued that Ein bein olam hazeh limos hamashiach ela shibud malchios bilvah. The only real difference between the world as it is presently constituted and the end of days, the time of the Messianic era, is that there will be political harmony and tranquility so that man will be able to pursue spiritual goals and aspirations. But the law of the Torah, says Shmuel, and Rambam Maimonides codifies this, will be exactly as it was. In other words, the law will exist in post-history, if one can call it that, as well as it does, or as much as it does, in the history itself. Maimonides codifies 13 principles of belief. Among those 13 are two which underscore the immutability and the singular importance of the halacha of Jewish law. One is the uniqueness of Mosaic prophecy. Of the 13, we're commanded to believe that there will never be another prophet of the same stature of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rambam explains that the reason that is so is because Moshe Rabbeinu was the vehicle for the giving of the Torah, of Jewish law. And since no prophet can supersede his prophecy, there can never be the superseding of the law, of the content of his prophecy. And of course, independently, one of the 13 is the belief that Jewish law is immutable. Again, that doesn't mean that it's not flexible, that it can't respond to changing circumstances, but the principles are permanent, immutable, they're applied creatively, and there's also rabbinic license, again, topics in their own right, so that the authors of the halacha, the practitioners of the halacha, can apply it in a relevant and an effective way, but the principles remain fixed. They are divine principles. Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the greatest prophet, he was also the first king of the Jewish people, first political leader, right? He was also the first Kohen Gadol, the first high priest of the Jewish people before Aaron. Nonetheless, his legacy, in the end of the day, is not Moshe HaNavi and not Moshe HaMelech and not Moshe, the first Kohen Gadol, but Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe who taught Klal Yisrael, not only in that generation, but for all generations to come. We have a category in Jewish law that is called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai, the law as transmitted all the way back from the legacy of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu's ultimate achievement is that he's Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher, the person who transmits the details and the methodology to interpret Jewish law. All of this points in the direction that we're dealing not merely with an efficient legal system, right? One which precludes anarchy, even one which transmits a couple of noble values, but with the raison d'etre of the Jewish people. The purpose of the Jewish people is to live according to Torah law, because that law, as we perceive it, uplifts us, ennobles us, inculcates within noble values, values which have the capacity to turn us into a mamleches kohanim begoy kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, escalated this idea in a very significant way. In his very famous essay called Isha Halacha, The Man of Halacha, The Man of Jewish Law, Rav Soloveitchik describes the halachic system as one which is a priori, a kind of blueprint for man's life, blueprint of creation. It's fascinating that in the little quote that I began with, Oliver Wendell Holmes in his famous classical work, so one of the things that he says is that the law is about experience. It's not about logic. And he says the law is not a work of mathematics or science. Rav Soloveitchik, in a number of his writings, actually compares Jewish law to mathematics and to science. I don't know whether he had the refutation of Oliver Wendell Holmes in mind or not, but in several of his works, he argues that the idealistic and the formalistic nature of Jewish law, the fact that it represents these ambitious values, constitutes in a way the principles of the world, in the same way that theoretical physics and mathematics are a system. They're like a pure system. They exist in the abstract. And then, of course, any good scientist and any good mathematician who also translates those principles of science into the world to create technology, to create a better society, knows exactly how to take the theory in the abstract, not to tarnish it, not to in any way dilute it, right? But to find a way to take these pure concepts and to apply them in a pragmatic way to enhance the world, to enhance society. So it's just interesting that exactly what Holmes was rejecting, speaking of secular law, is what Rav Soloveitchik embraces, again, not to the exclusion of the dynamism and the relevance, but to create an even more ambitious concept of law. What I'd like to do in this small time that I have left is to examine one aspect of Jewish law, in particular, where I think this different perspective, this idea that law isn't just about efficiency, it's also about efficiency. It's not just about pragmatism, even though it's also pragmatic and relevant, but that it represents values and is intended to ennoble man. I'd like to pursue this in one area in particular. Those of you who are familiar with the structure of the Mishnah, which is the earliest code of Jewish law, in a sense, although only Rashi Prakim, the certain basic ideas, which is then fleshed out by the Talmud, know that there are six areas of the Mishnah. If you're familiar with the latest code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, so there are four areas of the Shulchan Aruch, the Arba Chelkei Shulchan Aruch. Much of Jewish law has nothing to do with what others call law anyway, civil law. It has to do with laws of family, nashim, or what we call Evenu Ezer. It has to do with rituals connected with purity, taharos, or the workings of the Beit HaMikdash, the sacrificial rite, kodshim, things that have to do with festivals and other religious aspects of religious life, what we call Arachayim or Moed. Among those categories of law is civil law, what we call Choshen Mishpat in Shulchan Aruch, and Nezikin, the book of damages, which includes not only damages, but all aspects of civil law, acquisitions and damages and other interactions, questions of the legal system, the Sanhedrin, Edus, testimony. That is only one of six or one of four aspects of law. What's fascinating is if you look at Jewish sources and halachic sources, there seems to be a fundamental debate how to perceive Jewish civil law. On the one hand, it's clear that this is the one which overlaps the most with secular law, with other systems of law, whether it's Roman law or American law or British law, because the goal in Choshen Mishpat and civil law is the one which approximates those other systems. It's about a system creating a law, right, which allows productive, harmonious, right, interaction between different groups and different individuals. There's much overlap in those two things. At the same time, even as the more pragmatic aspect of Jewish civil law is self-evident, the fact that it is integrated with the total concept of Jewish law, which includes ritual purity and festivals and prayer and aspects of Ishus, marital law, all of which have an obvious spiritual and religious context, surely spills over, surely impacts on the Jewish concept of civil law as well. So what I'd like to do is just examine this very quickly. On the one hand, Jewish civil law is far more flexible than any other area of Jewish law, because it's self-evident, again, that the interaction between people requires greater flexibility for effectiveness and efficiency. Moreover, the protectionism, which is part of the motive for such law, you have laws of damages, you have laws of commercial transaction, you have laws of testimony, all of these things are more easily relinquished when people agree, when you can strike a compromise. The role of peace, put it that way, is going to be greater, has no role in ritual law, it has significant role in Jewish civil law. So for example, we find that even though we have a rule which is Ein adam masna al masha kasu b'Torah, a man cannot agree to relinquish his rights or his obligations in other matters of halacha. But when it comes to dinei mamonos, when it comes to Jewish civil law, there's a debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. Mostly we accept the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Adam masna al masha kasu b'Torah b'tnai davar shebamamon. When two people agree that they're going to operate outside of the strict requirements of Jewish law, but they agree and it affects only them, then that is permissible. We have another concept called hefker beit din hefker, that the Jewish court system has, in the matter of monetary matters, they have the right to swoop in and to exert their authority, even if that technically overrides something in the law. That's their capacity. There's a concept of dina d'malchusa, dina, which we're all familiar with, which is if Jews and Jewish communities live outside of Eretz Yisrael, so then they have to respect indigenous law. They have to respect the local law. These all reflect a certain flexibility of Jewish civil law. At the same time, it's interesting to note that Jewish civil law is part of the bigger picture, and there are limits in that flexibility. For example, as we noted, Rabbi Meir, we don't accept his view, but his view highlights a certain perspective, says even if the two parties were to agree to drop the requirements of Jewish law in civil law, they wouldn't be allowed to do so. Even though we do accept the condition, the idea that there is greater flexibility in civil law, there are certain areas, for example, according to Maimonides, when it comes to the laws of inheritance, because they reflect the value of family structure and not merely the disbursement of property between individuals, Rambam says you cannot relinquish those laws. You have to relate to them as they are. That's a topic also in its own right. Let me take it a step further. The Gemara here in Masechet Brachos essentially highlights the problem. If you look here on page 2 of the handouts, so you'll see there's a little bit of a different font on the bottom. The second to last a piece, Talmud Bavli Masechet Brachos Vav Amud Aleph. The Gemara here says that when three judges sit together, the Shechina, the indwelling presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam, is among them as well. Beautiful concept. When people judge honestly, God's presence, ki'ilu, kivyachal, right, acknowledges their good work. So the Gemara says this about three judges. And then the Gemara asks, v'b'chima achar da'filu trei plasami boy. If the Gemara had said previously that two righteous individuals sitting together are sitting with the Shechina, then why is it necessary to mention this with regard to three? So the Gemara says, Ma'u desema dina shalma bi'almahu v'lo asya Shechina kamash malon d'dina nami hainu Torah. The Gemara says a remarkable thing. You might have thought three judges adjudicating a civil law case are basically trying to affect what? Peace. They're trying to create a situation of stability and tranquility between the two parties. Is that really Torah? It's pragmatic justice. It's Oliver Wendell Holmes. And I don't say it disparagingly. I think it's a fine formulation. The Gemara says that's not true, and that's what the Gemara wants you to know. It's more than peace. Properly implementing the principles, and therefore the values implied by those principles, constitutes Torah, not just Shalom. The next piece, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Davav Amud Beis, essentially says that it looks like this is the debate between Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, no less. Two greater disputants you probably could not imagine. What are they arguing about? The Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin discusses what is the status of pshara. Pshara is compromise. In other words, you have a din Torah, there's an adjudication going on. The judges can either strictly apply the Jewish laws, the principles, or they can say, listen, let's try to get together and find an equitable solution, right, that everybody will be happy with. That's called pshara, compromise. So the Gemara quotes a debate whether pshara is preferable. Everybody agrees that compromise is possible. The question is, do we initially counsel towards pshara, compromise, or din, pure justice? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Elazar ben Osher, Rabbi Yosi HaGlili Omer, Asur Liptzor, you're not allowed to suggest compromise initially. You should try for the ideal just solution. The Kolabotzea Hareza Chote, not only that, it's even somewhat of a transgression to compromise the law. The Kolam Mevarech HaSabotzea Hareza Menoi, Tzal Zenemar, Botzea Berech Nietz Hashem. Ella rather, Yikov Adina Sahar, let the mountain, you know, be knocked down before we compromise the values of the law. Shenemar ki ha-mishpat le'lokim hu, God himself is connected to the concept of justice. V'chein Moshe ha-yomer, this was the view of Moshe Rabbeinu, Yikov ha-din ha-sahar. Aval, however, Aaron, oev shalom barodev shalom. Aaron, everybody knows, used to pursue peace, used to always make compromises between people, meisim shalom edanim l'chaveir, shenemar, toras emes ha-yisa b'fiyu ba'avla lo nimtza v'sfasav, B'shalom mishar halach, and so on. The Gemara goes on to explain, at least according to most interpretations, it's not that Moshe represented din and Aaron represented peace. Aaron understood that part of the function of din, part of the ideal function of din, was peace. According to some views, compromise that produces peace is also regulated by the law. It has to be within certain parameters of justice. In other words, once again, we have a really interesting debate whether or not even the civil part of Jewish law, how pragmatic and efficient, to what extent is it promoting a result that people are happy with, as opposed to the ideal conclusion or solution of the din. Let's take it a step further. There's a very famous discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. How do you know that you require three authentic judges for certain adjudication, called smuchim, smicha, ordination, rabbinic ordination? So the Gemara says the source for requiring three judges with rabbinic ordination is the word Elokim. V'nikra balabayis elho Elokim, adho Elohim, yavo shnehem. The Torah several times uses the word, the expression, I'm saying it this way, you'll see in a moment, Elohim, right? When it clearly doesn't mean God. It's a reference to judges. Judges are sometimes called Elohim, which is why I'm pronouncing it Elohim. The Gemara says that in those parshios, which we'll read in a couple of weeks, Parshas Mishpatim, the term Elohim is used for judge three times. And that's a source that you require three authentic judges. Isn't that a remarkable thing? That the source of judicial authority in the halacha comes from the word Elohim, right? Which is, of course, the same word that we use to signify Elokim, the name of God. As if to say what the Gemara in Brachos said, which is, when justice is pursued nobly and properly, sometimes the compromise aspect is an aspect of justice too. But when it is pursued that way, then the Elohim are doing the work of Elokim. It's Elokim, Vayigba Hashem Tzivakos Bamishpat. God himself stands at the top or the apex of the judicial system. There's a very fascinating Gemara in Masechet Gittin. The Gemara says that Jews, ideally, should adjudicate their disputes in a Jewish court and not in a secular court. The Eila HaMishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem, Lifnehem Velo Lifnei Arkos. Of course, if there's no recourse to justice other than secular court, that's a different issue, and then again, the parameters of that are a topic in its own right as well. But normally, the rule is that you have to try to solve your disputes within the framework of Jewish law and Jewish courts. The Gemara, however, adds and says that this is true afilu kishadinehem kedinenu. This is true even if the statute, the statutes in question on the matter are identical. Let's say the secular legal system agrees totally with the Jewish legal system on the way this dispute should be resolved. Nonetheless, going to a non-halachic court constitutes a violation of the Isser of Arkos. Ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lefnehem. The justice should go before them, Jewish courts, the lo lefnei Arkos. That's very strange. If we're interested in a certain efficient or noble conclusion, right? If the laws are the same and they're going to be applied the same, then what's the problem? It's even more significant than that. I don't have time to go into the details right now, but let me just say give you the short part of the story, and that is as follows. One of the seven Noahide laws, one of the seven laws that apply not only to Jews, but from a Jewish law point of view, are incumbent upon every human being, is the law of dinim, justice. The question is, what is justice? Rambam's view is very limited. I'm not going to read it inside because it's a little too late. But the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim says that justice means there are seven rules. Really, there are six rules, says the Rambam. You're not allowed to steal. You're not allowed to worship idols. There are six rules. The seventh, dinim, is to implement the first six. Anybody who stands by and does not implement the first six violations when there's a violation is in violation of the seventh dinim. The Ramban disagrees. Ramban says dinim means that non-Jews like Jews are obligated to have a comprehensive civil law system. The Ramban says this, I'll just read a couple of lines very quickly. If you look on page 2, you'll see the beginning not beginning of it, but the first time there's a paragraph. This is the Ramban in Parshas Vayishlach. Ve'al dati hadinim shamanu lebnei Noach, the sheva mitzvah shalahem, enam lahoshiv dayanu b'kopelach u'pelach bovad. The obligation of dinim is not merely to have judges sitting and implementing the other six. Aval tziva osam b'dinei geneva, b'onav, b'oshek, u'tzchar sachir, b'dinei shomrim. Rather, it's the obligation for non-Jews to have a comprehensive legal system which relates to all aspects of civil law, theft and charging interest and dailies and onus and mabata and office azikim and damages, chova b'chaveiro, mal v'lova, lending and borrowing, dine mekachu memkar, transactions of kiyotza bahen. He adds, ki'inyan ha-dinim shenitzdavu Yisrael. Just like the dinim of Choshen Mishpat, the Jews are commanded. So there's a fundamental debate about this point between the Ramah and the Netziv. The Ramah, the great codifier of Ashkenazic Jewish law, in a tshuva, in a responsum, says that the Ramban here meant that non-Jews, ideally, are obligated to embrace the system of Choshen Mishpat. Our Choshen Mishpat is the best system, and therefore they should embrace that. That's what dinim means. They should observe the Choshen Mishpat. The Netziv disagrees. The Netziv says the Ramban said like Choshen Mishpat. He didn't say Choshen Mishpat. And if you take the view of the Ramah, then you'd come to a very peculiar difficulty. Because if non-Jews are supposed to embrace Jewish civil law, Choshen Mishpat, then how could there be an Isser Arkos? How could you say you're not allowed to go to a non-Jewish court if the non-Jewish courts should be practicing Jewish civil law? Again, this is all theoretical. We can't impose this on anyone. We're not trying to. But even theoretically, the Netziv says, if the Ramah was right that the comprehensive legal system that every nation, every culture should adopt would be that of Jewish law, then how would you explain the prohibition of Arkos, which is a biblical law in its own right? Therefore, the Netziv says, the obligation of non-Jews to have a legal system from Jewish law point of view is to have a fair, a just legal system in a very flexible way. How do we explain the Ramah? So I think that the answer is along the lines that we've been discussing, and that is as follows. If Jewish civil law were just about, it's a very excellent system, it's very comprehensive, it's fair, it's consistent, it's divinely inspired, some of it is actually divinely commanded, so it's an amazing system. But if we were to look at it the same way that we look at secular law, and that is it's intended exclusively for efficiency, for effectiveness, to preclude anarchy and so on. If we were to look at Choshen Mishpat that way, and then we were to conclude, as the Rama did, that non-Jews, ideally, should embrace the system of Jewish civil law, then Itziv's question would be a devastating question. But the point is as follows. Torah says in Parshas Shoftim, when you have a difficulty, bein dam ladam, bein din ladin, bein nega lanega, in any area of Jewish law, who do you go to? The Bezin Hagadol sitting right next to the Beis HaMikdash. They're the single authority for all types of Jewish law. There's no difference between civil law and any other law. All of the Torah is one. If you look at the Torah, whenever it speaks about civil law, there could be a pasuk later that it's speaking about ritual law. Notwithstanding the differences, which are obvious, more important, civil law is one of the six categories of the Mishnah and one of the four of the Shulchan Aruch. The methodology of civil law is identical to the methodology of the other laws. The point is that a civil Jewish civil law, which is part of the other aspects of Jewish law, and whose basis is the imitation of the Rabbonu Shalom himself, the internalization of values, that Choshen Mishpat, even if the content is the same, but the goal and the perspective that surrounds it is different. And if that's true, then the Rama is 100% right, and that's the idea of our kos. If you were to go to a non-Jewish legal system, when you had access to a Jewish one, because the laws were the same, what you'd be saying is, I only care about the efficiency and pragmatic effectiveness of the law. I don't care that this law is connected also to the observance of Shabbos, to having a certain kind of marital life, right, to the aspiration of bringing sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash. I just see it as an efficient legal system. And that's the prohibition of our kos. A true appreciation and understanding of Jewish civil law, understanding that while there are some differences, it's integrated into the rest of the law, is one which generates the ambition to inculcate those values, not only that they should bring harmony to society, but that they should be transformative to each and every individual in his study of them. Let me conclude with two very quick remarks. The Midrash here, on the bottom of page 2, Shmos Rabba, has a wonderful story. Ve'el ha-mishpatim magid dvarav li'akov, pam akas amar lo akilos la'daryonis ha-melech, rotani li'iskayer li'asos Yisrael. He said, he turned to the king and he said, I'd like to convert and become a Jew. Omar lo, so the king responded, and he said, le'uma zu atam avakesh, kama bazisi osa, kama rakti osa, li'rudu shev'umas atam avakesh, le'hitarev. You want to join the Jewish people? Don't you see how much trouble they always have? Their difficulties. I myself have imposed difficulties upon them. What's the advantage? Mara isa bahem shatarotza diskayer. What have you seen that you want to convert? So he answered, Omalo hakotan shabahem yodea eich para kadosh baruch hu isa olam. They're interested in the bigger questions. Even the smallest among them knows, you know, speaks about creation and the length of creation, ma nivra biyom rishon, ma nivra biyom sheni, kama yesh mishnivra olam. It's a different culture. It's a culture which focuses, right, on aspirations, on ideals, on creation, on the God. Ba'mala olam momed, v'tarasan emes, what the purpose of the world is. So then the king turned to him and he said, amar lo lech ulamod tarasan. So go to their yeshivas. Why do you have to convert? Go take some classes. Al timo, but don't undergo a bris milah. Says anybody knows, no matter how old, how wise, unless he undergoes the symbolically the equivalent of a bris milah, he can't really study their Torah. The person who gives law, including Choshen Mishpat, to the Jewish people, did not give this to any other nation. What is the Midrash saying? Exactly this point. To take the law out of context, but not to be bound by its totality, to know intellectually, but not to undergo the bris milah, to be an observer of Jewish civil law, without understanding and appreciating that it's integrated into the totality of all of Jewish law, in other words, to see it as pragmatic and efficient and effective, but not to see it as ennobling and as cultivating midos tovos and good values is to miss the point. So that as these and other lectures continue, the study of halacha, the study of Jewish law, is not merely the study of any legal system. Indeed, it's a study of an efficient system, an effective system, one which has been operating for millennia in different circumstances. That dynamism is part of the story. But at the same time, inspiringly, it's really the study of values, and it's the study of the purpose of life. Thank you.